Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody with Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic on I-10 eastbound, a crash at Guadalupe has two lanes blocked. Elsewhere, I-10 eastbound, a crash at the 60 and on the 61 at Rural. Sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon. We are still under an excessive heat warning until 8 o'clock tonight. Look for a high of 111. Partly cloudy tonight, overnight lows in the mid-80s. Sunny at 110 for a high tomorrow. It's 106 degrees right now.
Phoenix police have arrested four people who blocked Central Avenue for more than an hour to protest the Supreme Court's decision today on DAPA. From KJZZ's West Valley Bureau, Matthew Casey reports.
It started out like any rally. Speakers from a coalition of immigrant rights groups passed a bullhorn and decried a Supreme Court deadlock that prevents about 4 million immigrants from getting driver's licenses and work permits. But then, the group of about 75 protesters flooded into Central Avenue and blocked traffic.
When migrant families are under attack, what do you do?
One of the protesters was Berta Avila. She has lived in the United States for decades, would have qualified for DAPA, and is frustrated by the decision.
Our Hispanic people are treated like slaves, working 8 hours a day for a dollar. And here on the outside, they put us in shackles because they think we're a danger to escape.
Avila says she spent months in a detention center in Eloy. A mother of five U.S. citizens, she's in deportation proceedings. She says she has no lawyer and is next due in court in August. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Today's Supreme Court decision will deeply affect thousands of immigrants and their families in Arizona. The group Living United for Change in Arizona, or LUCCHA, provides information and assistance to people with questions about DAPA and DACA. Stephanie Maldonado is a field organizer for LUCCHA, and she joins me. Stephanie, what was your personal reaction when you heard about the Supreme Court ruling?
Me personally, I felt pretty heartbroken because I felt like we gave so much hope to our community. We were telling them, you know, we were giving all that hope to not be lost because we are hopeful people. And this morning when I saw the messages and just read about it, it was just very heartbreaking. But it also made me feel that more empowered to continue to fight for all those families.
You say continue to fight. What does the fight look like now then? What steps can be taken that you think haven't been taken already, or do those steps need to be taken in a stronger way?
I think we just have to work stronger together, continue to get with our community, you know, see what we can do, and just become stronger.
Now, is this about convincing people who are not otherwise convinced, or is it about getting people who are already on your team to work even harder?
I think it's starting to, you know, go out of our comfort zone and talking to those other individuals that may not, you know, they might not see it the same way we do. And try to get more people on board on, you know, what our mission is and why we're, you know, why we believe that families need the opportunity to be here and have the opportunity to work to continue to, you know, provide for those families that are already here. So I believe that's how we want to fight, continue to fight.
So at its core, that would be the message you would make sure that people know about, or is there something else as well?
I think more than anything is just to understand why we're doing this and how we're going to get, why the community needs to be strong and, you know, put efforts and align with individuals who have similar beliefs and those that are, you know, they're like, we need to continue to talk to them and, you know, stress why it's super important that we have those opportunities for those that aren't as fortunate as the rest of us.
Based on what I've read about what LUCCHA does, there is a lot of guidance provided to people to know, you know, do I qualify for DACA? How does DAPA work and whatnot? Have you had a chance yet to talk with some people who have come to LUCCHA for help and gotten their reaction? And how do they feel? Do they feel like they can continue the fight?
As of today, you know, we are the community, a lot of us are trying to put that, you know, continue to inform our community of what has happened because of maybe some people don't fully understand or comprehend, you know, that 4-4 decision. So we're definitely going to continue to inform our community so they feel like this isn't over because, you know, a lot of people tend to lose that hope that we have. So we want to continue to embed in them that there is hope, you know, within us as a community and that we're going to just continue to do this, you know, stronger than ever.
Stephanie Maldonado is a field organizer for Living United for Change in Arizona, or LUCCHA.
A coalition including members of the state legislature and city councils has filed a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of a new law set to take effect later this summer. House Bill 2579 precludes city from regulating, quote, non-wage compensation, which it defines as items including sick and vacation pay. The bill was a response to a 2013 measure which tried to block cities from setting their own living wage. But Attorney General Mark Brnovich agreed not to enforce that law since it conflicted with the voter-approved minimum wage measure. Tempe Councilwoman Lauren Kuby is one of the plaintiffs in this new suit, and she joins me. Councilwoman Kuby, why in your mind is this year's law unconstitutional?
It's blatantly unconstitutional because in 2006, the voters passed Prop 202 overwhelmingly. And in that proposition, which is voter protected, there's a clear authorization for cities to regulate wages and benefits.
The law, though, sort of separates out things like sick time as not something that is constituted by wages and benefits. So is there an argument to be made that the legislature sort of carved this out, thereby allowing the state to tell cities that you can't do this?
So, yeah, the law tried to define benefits in its own triangulated way, but clearly the law from 2006 states that wages and benefits, and if you define paid sick leave as a benefit, as I think most rational people do, that law is voter protected. Arizona has a very strong tool in its toolkit, and that is the Voter Protection Act. So the legislature was required to have a three-quarters majority, and they were required to affirm the intent of the law, and they did neither. They did not get a three-quarters majority, and they did not affirm the law. They actually tried to take away from the 2006 law.
Why should cities be in the business of regulating this sort of thing as opposed to the state?
Yes, well, we have 19 chartered cities in the state of Arizona, and chartered cities are explicitly authorized to regulate the general health and welfare of the populations that they govern. And so to me, worker protection is fundamental to the general welfare and the public health of our city. And a city's values or residents' values are reflected in the laws that they pass. And we have charter city protection. And this is one of those cases where home rule, local control, local decision making trumps any kind of state interference in that local democracy.
In your mind, how is paid sick time sort of a worker health issue?
Well, let's look at the public health issue. Do we really want someone coughing in our food or someone who serves or prepares our food to be sick? There's been a study done that shows 56% of restaurant workers frequently go to work sick. So it's a matter of health and the public health. Arizona is one of the poorer states in the nation. We have in Tempe, 38% of our residents are eligible for services provided by our Tempe Community Action Agency. We have a 22% poverty rate. Families are feeling the pinch of this economy. And not to have even one sick day to protect them when they have a child who's sick, when they have a family member who's sick, or when they're sick themselves, just doesn't make sense. It just adds to insecurity of the family. You shouldn't have to choose between a paycheck and your health or your family's health.
Do you have a sense of how many either Tempe residents or Arizonans are in this situation where they have a job that does not provide them paid sick leave?
Yeah, in Arizona, it's over 900,000 workers do not have even a single sick day. And it's about 45% of the population of workers. In Tempe, it's 46% of our workers do not have even a single sick day to fall back upon.
So in your city, what are you trying to do about that? Are you looking to have a minimum number, a floor of paid sick days that all workers have to get?
Yes, that's what we were doing in Tempe. We had a study group, and we are working to craft an ordinance that would be unique to our university community. So we were looking at a baseline protection of 3 to 5 days for workers. We were trying to work with the business community to craft something that was, that makes sense for our businesses and for our workers and our community. But we were chilled in that effort by the legislative overreach.
Tempe City Councilwoman Lauren Kuby is a co-plaintiff in the lawsuit challenging the new state law that says cities are not allowed to regulate things like paid sick time. Councilwoman Kuby, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
A handful of Valley cities are talking about something the state does not seem inclined to discuss, raising taxes. Phoenix, Peoria, and Surprise are just some of the cities that have considered increasing their taxes or asking voters to raise them. To get a sense of what's behind this, I'm joined by Ken Strobeck, Executive Director of the League of Arizona Cities and Towns. And Ken, what do you make of this trend?
Well, first of all, I don't really think it's a trend. I think you have to look at cities on an individual basis and evaluate what their particular situation is. Every one of them is unique in terms of what their tax base is, what their service level is, what cuts they have made out of the recession, and what their citizens are demanding in terms of public services and what the needs are in that particular community. However, having said that, I do think that there is a definitely a backlog of obligations and work that needs to be done that has been deferred as a result of the recession. I went back and looked, and you know, when we were in the depths of the recession, the average city budget was down about 20%. So I think what you're seeing is an effort to try to sort of catch up with some things that might have been deferred, such as road maintenance or work on utilities, public infrastructure, those kinds of things, as well as now some cities are bringing back police officers and firefighters and folks like that.
So do you think that the fact that cities are starting to look at this now, is that an indication that the needs they have just reached a critical point where they can't wait any longer? Is it a matter of the economy is such that they think their residents can absorb some of these additional costs?
I think it's probably a combination of both, but I think the pressure to actually catch up with some of the things that have been delayed or deferred is a greater consideration. And also you have to take a look at the impact of various state legislation on our ability to raise revenue locally. And two of the most critical issues in that category are impact fees and changes to the construction sales tax. And as a result of both of those pieces of legislation that actually went into effect over the last few years, we have seen revenues in both of those categories decline even as building activity has increased.
What has been the impact on Arizona cities of the fact that Governor Ducey and the state legislature are basically saying we are not going to raise taxes pretty much no matter what?
Well, you know, there is a state requirement that every city and town has to have a balanced budget every single year, and those have to be audited. So we don't have the ability to say, well, we're going to defer or we're going to roll things over till next year or, you know, do some those kinds of gimmicky kind of things that that may happen at other levels. So if there are certain services that are needed in a community, those have to be paid for on a pay-as-you-go basis. And so that's where you see cities and towns having to make those decisions about raising revenue at the local level that maybe the state has decided they're not going to do.
Ken Strobank is Executive Director of the League of Arizona Cities and Towns. For another perspective, I'm joined by economist Alan McGuire. He's president of the McGuire Company and has a lot of experience working on state budgets. And Alan, let me ask you, what do you think about cities starting to look at potentially raising taxes?
Yeah, well, I think it's just sort of a time in the cycle, right? A lot of things have happened in the last 10 years. If you think about where we are, 2006 versus 2016, 2006, there were a lot of people walking around thinking, this is never going to end. 2016, they're thinking, this is never going to end, but for completely different reasons. So I think that's sort of where we are in people's thought process, particularly elected officials.
So do you think that cities are looking at needs they have and say, okay, we have to do X, Y, and Z, and we think now that residents might be amenable to paying a little bit more to do those, whereas before maybe they wouldn't have been?
Well, I think it's a little longer story than that. In the 2000s, the housing bubble really, really hit Arizona hard. So what did that do? It created a ton of extra revenue. Probably not real revenue, but a ton of extra revenue. And then came the financial crisis and the bursting of the housing bubble, and all that revenue disappeared, plus more. That was followed by the crisis. And during the crisis, pretty much everybody was willing to wait a little while. You can cut my salary. You can give me a furlough. You can reduce my program for
with the
a
expectation
while.
That it would get better and those things would come back.
Would come back. And I think that's where we are.
So you spent a lot of time working in state government, working on state budgets. How much do state legislators, when they're crafting their budget, think about what kind of impact what they are doing might have on what cities might have to do and how cities might meet their needs?
So I think pretty much everybody budgets pretty much in isolation, right? It's almost like you put on your blinders and you say, What are my existing revenues? What are my incremental revenues? So what can I do different? And there's very little thought about what that does to the next guy.
So do you think that the situation for cities would be different if, for example, the legislature and governor were willing to at least consider a tax increase on the state level? Might cities not have to increase them on their levels?
Well, certainly if there was an action taken that increased state shared revenues so that more money was subvented from the state down to the local governments, that would help local government budgets. That's probably a fairly long shot. I mean, to the extent that the state's going to raise revenues, they're going to probably raise it for state purposes and maybe not even share it. Certainly it would help, but probably not in the high probability.
Do you think that we'll continue to see more cities looking to do this?
I think the pressure is there. I think it is offset by the financial pressure that average households are feeling. The Arizona economy is doing pretty well. We're creating quite a few jobs. We're a top 15 state now. We used to be a top one or two state. So we're recovering, but not like we did in the old days. But there's constant demand for new services, and those new services need a funding source.
Economist Alan McGuire is president of the Phoenix-based McGuire Company.
Presumptive Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump has had strong words about illegal immigration. He's calling for a new border wall that would be paid for by Mexico. He's also said it would make sense to deport the estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants currently in the U.S. So if Trump were to win the presidency this November and was able to implement those plans, how could that affect the Phoenix area's housing market? Catherine Rager, senior real estate journalist for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central, wrote a column recently about reactions she got from housing experts around the valley to Trump's proposal, and she joins me now. Catherine, you agreed to keep these people anonymous. What did the experts tell you?
It was basic as supply and demand. You know, we know when SB 1070 happened that both legal and illegal immigrants left the state, and that coincided with our housing crash, so it was hard to see the direct impact, but we know it was worse. And some people would go on the record. I wanted to be fair. And during that time when I did stories, it's a very divisive issue, obviously. But it came down to if, you know, we know how many potentially immigrants we have here who aren't here legally. There's really good national research on that. And if you look at how many could leave, about 190,000 here, that's about 100,000 households. And if that massive deportation plan goes into effect, that's 100,000 fewer households filled here. And so you look at that, and if that happens very quickly, what that does to our housing market, again, simply supply and demand. You have empty houses, empty apartments, foreclosures, and that becomes an issue. Of course, on the flip side, and I talked to Senator Kavanaugh, he thinks that's a good thing because then we have that affordable housing we need for other residents to come here legally.
Because the Phoenix market has been so odd really over the past decade or so with those extreme highs and extreme lows, when it comes to a normal housing market, if we can put it that way, how much of that is based on a healthy rise in prices? When you talk about Senator Kavanaugh saying, well, it'll make housing more affordable potentially, but at what stage does affordable housing meet where investors feel like they want to invest here and the idea that people can actually profit from having this property?
You know, we are an affordable housing market, but we are still recovering from the crash. We're about 11% behind what our peak price was, and it's been very steady, and growth has been good and healthy for the past few years. Almost 200,000 people leave and you have many empty apartments and potential foreclosures, and if it happens very quickly, you know, you're going to see, one housing analyst said, you're going to see investors who bought houses before and have been renting saying, hey, this is probably the time to sell. I don't know what's going to happen to the market. And if foreclosures climb, that means cheaper houses on the market. Of course, lenders turn around and sell those. And we have a lot of apartments under construction. Many are luxury, but if we have a dip in prices, you know, it spreads through the market.
Catherine, finally, in the column, you said that you kept people anonymous, so please send angry emails to your email address. Did you, in fact, get angry emails, and were the angry emails that you felt like there was some thought behind the anger as well?
Yes. No, I did receive, I think, about half, for and against from emails, and I received many. And responded, and we had some good conversations. And some people are unhappy just about, the status of someone isn't here legally, what it means to be illegally. And so it becomes a very big political issue, and I had to keep going back to, I respect your feelings, your opinions, your political thoughts. I'm just looking at the housing market and supply and demand, and what if it means if we have this many people leave and not more people coming in fast enough, what that does to our home prices and our what it means for homeowners and renters.
Catherine Rager is senior real estate journalist for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central.
The U.S. Border Patrol is facing criticism for the way it administers polygraph exams on would-be hires. The agency has fielded complaints from applicants, members of Congress, and the agency's union. From KJZZ's Fronteras Desk in Tucson, Michelle Marisco reports.
Customs and Border Protection was required to give polygraphs 6 years ago to all of its applicants for frontline jobs. That includes port inspectors and Border Patrol agents. Officials say the test was implemented to weed out corruption in the ranks. The agency is also under pressure by Congress to hire 1,300 more Border Patrol agents. But critics say what they see as a heavy-handed polygraph examination is hurting those recruitment efforts. Tucson Border Patrol Union President Art Del Cueto.
They're supposed to be doing the polygraph testing, and then they do the report and they send it through. But that's not what's been happening, at least not in Tucson sector.
Rather than passing the results of the polygraph on, in the Tucson sector, Del Cueto says one person was made responsible for administering the lie detector test and deciding whether or not to fail an applicant.
What's been happening in Tucson sector is that the individual that's been doing the actual polygraph test, he's acting as the judge, the jury, and executioner.
The issue has come up before. Republican Congresswoman Martha McSally chairs the House's Border and Maritime Security Subcommittee and grilled CBP last April.
Itself, we have heard several anecdotal horror stories of decorated combat veterans who for some reason were unable to pass this polygraph, coupled with some bizarre sounding behavior on the behalf of the polygraph examiners.
A CBP official told her their program follows federal standards and said polygraph examiners are monitored on a daily basis and that their audio recordings are checked. Del Cueto read from one complaint, a woman who recently failed her CBP polygraph exam, and sent him an email about it.
He told me that my readings were similar to that of a Russian spy or something that had been very carefully or someone that had been very carefully trained. I asked him what was the cause of failure, and he stated, "I failed for drugs and for falsifying my application." He also told me that he knew that I was lying as they already had information about me in the criminal database. He stated that this was known since before I arrived at the office. I told him that it was not accurate, and he said, "It doesn't matter." He stated he talked to another co-worker while on break and told him I was probably scared to tell the truth.
The writer of the email also said the examiner shared past lie detector stories with her.
He then said he knew I manipulated the machine and that there were so many ways I could have done it, like curl my toes, count backward, etc., etc.
David Fruchtman is a private contractor who administers polygraphs for law enforcement and other clients in Tucson.
Polygraph examiners are now called psychophysiological detection of deception experts.
Or lie detectors.
From time to time, almost everyone's had the experience of somebody trying to sell them something or convince them of something, and you get the feeling in the back of your mind that that individual isn't telling you the truth. Frequently, what's happening is they're noticing autonomic nervous system changes in the individual who's potentially lying to them, but it's below their threshold of conscious perception.
In other words, you see changes, but you don't recognize what you're seeing. He pulls out a series of cables for pulses, for changes in skin resistance, and for blood flow.
We also have a sensor on the chair that detects any kind of movement from the person that would be used to detect any type of countermeasures that an applicant may attempt during an examination.
Lie detecting, he says, is a precise science. He points to the different charts on a recent exam.
And that's showing me changes in pulse wave amplitude, relative blood pressure, and pulse rate. And finally,
so
you see down here
lying?
A yellow line. This person's telling the truth.
CBP declined an interview about the allegations made against its polygraph examiner in Tucson. A spokesman emailed a list of bullet points on the agency's polygraph policies, but did not answer questions about those policies. According to the union, 80% of those who fail polygraph exams in Tucson go to work for other law enforcement agencies who administer their own polygraph exams. Michelle Marisco, KJZZ News, Tucson.
A battle between a federal agency and many in the community of Lake Havasu City has been raging in recent months after the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service put out a proposal to limit recreational boating on part of the Havasu National Wildlife Refuge. The department cited safety concerns and potential environmental impacts when it submitted a compatibility determination in April that would have extended no-wake zones in the refuge. But officials were met with such protests from the community, business leaders, and lawmakers, they just withdrew the proposal. And the show's Lauren Gilger spoke with some of the key players in all of this. And Lauren, this even got the attention of Senators John McCain and Jeff Flake. How did this all begin?
Well, back in May of 2015, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service put some boating restrictions on about a half mile of the refuge after they said that a safety issue had been reported. And this year, they were proposing adding another 2 square miles of area to those restrictions.
Watercraft must travel at no wake speeds on water under the refuge jurisdiction, including backwaters and other defined areas.
That's Mojave County Supervisor Buster Johnson. And as you might be able to tell by his tone there, he's not a fan of these restrictions or expanding them.
We get about 3.5 million boating visitors a year in Lake Havasu, and a lot of them use this area that they're putting under restrictions. A lot of people learn to ski up there because it's a real calm, quiet area where you could take the kids and teach them to ski without being bothered by other boaters. But it would cripple the economy here.
So he says the proposal affects everyone, boaters, businesses, tourists, and none of them were happy about this. They held a public meeting about it, and Johnson says thousands of people came.
It was the most people I've seen show up for a meeting, and I've been in office 20 years.
So what area are we talking about exactly here?
So the refuge is actually only about 3% of the whole lake, according to Fish and Wildlife. But Johnson says it's a critical portion. The Havasu National Wildlife Refuge is along the river that runs downstream into Lake Havasu. So it connects the lake with Needles, Fort Mojave, and eventually all the way up to Laughlin. And Johnson says boaters like to go up there and go to restaurants or to travel up to Laughlin for the day.
We have jet ski rentals and boat rentals and people who rent dive gear, that sort of thing. And then we have the people who have tours where you can come out and get on the boat and you can take a tour up through the gorge going up. And they explain to you about the animal life and the plant life and how everything came to be.
But I also talked with Christine Tincher. She's a spokesperson for the Fish and Wildlife Service. And she says there have actually been similar restrictions in place along about 17 miles of the waterway for some time. And even though it's a popular area for lots of people to go, that's not why it was established.
The National Wildlife Refuge was established for migratory birds and habitat and having some shoreline for nesting to ensure that the habitat, you know, is maintained and cared for.
And Lauren, is she worried about the boats hurting the habitat there?
Yes. She says first they got a complaint about safety because of boats speeding by, but they also are worried about the effect that they could have on the environment.
Sometimes even the shifting of silt is going to impact the area. If migratory species are coming in and nesting along the shoreline, if you're coming through at a great speed in some areas, then you could affect a nest that was in the tall grass. So what we would be looking at is having some compatible uses that would basically be in harmony so that the impact to the wildlife or the habitat is minimal or can be done in balance. Fishing, bird watching, hiking.
So they dropped the proposal.
Right. Fish and Wildlife says they got so much comment on this. They heard the community's concerns and they want to talk with stakeholders and people in the community more about it before they make any final decisions.
So are folks in Lake Havasu relieved?
Well, after talking to Buster Johnson, I'd say no. He sees this as federal overreach and says it's not over till it's over.
We still need to be vigilant on this because that's always an old trick of government or anybody else to lay low for a while and then try to sneak it back in.
So obviously much more to come on this, Mark.
That's the show's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you, Mark.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Hi, my name is Tristan Gaynor, and I'm a lifeguard at Sunny Slope Pool. A lot of people think, oh, you know, summer lifeguard, you just sit out in a chair and get tan all day. But, you know, it's actually a really intense, high-stress job.
Hey, step out of the pool! Come out!
And the drills we do here are really important because it keeps us up on our skills.
One, two, three.
Someone goes in the water, pretends they're drowning, and we have to react as if it's a real emergency happening.
Stand clear.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Big part of the job is prevention.
Ready? 1, 2, 3.
Saying, you know, walk on the deck, or young lady, please don't hold your breath too long. And when something does happen, we're ready to go.
That's Tristan Gaynor, lifeguarding at a public pool. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want to borrow our floaties, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org. It's The Show on 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein along with Mark Brody. College baseball's World Series is well underway in Omaha, Nebraska, and the University of Arizona Wildcats are still alive in the double elimination tournament. Arizona was national champion in 2012, but missed the postseason for the next 3 years, making this year's success a stunner. To learn more, I'm joined by Michael Lev. He covers U of A baseball for the Arizona Daily Star. Michael, was this a big surprise for U of A?
It is a huge surprise because they were picked to finish ninth in the Pac-12 by the league's coaches. You know, you can take those sorts of polls for what they're worth, but that does give you some gauge of what the expectation level was outside the program. Well, I mean, Jay Johnson refused to accept that. He went to work. He reworked and retooled some of the swings of some of the older players who had underachieved during their careers. As a result, their first baseman, their second baseman, their right fielder, they're all having career years as seniors, which is highly unusual. In college baseball, usually players peak as juniors. They get drafted and they go pro. Their top pitcher, Nathan Bannister, was kind of overweight in summer, hadn't really lived up to his potential. Johnson put out a mandate for all the pitchers to get into better shape. Nathan Bannister really took that to heart, dropped more than 30 pounds, and became one of the best pitchers in college baseball.
I want to ask you a question about Omaha, because the College Baseball World Series has almost kind of a Field of Dreams feel to it. It always has. There's sort of that, okay, maybe college baseball's popularity waxes and wanes, but when it comes to that College World Series, it's just that special place to be in Omaha. Do you feel that? What does it feel like to you as a journalist and a guy who covers these young players?
It absolutely feels like that. This is my first experience here in Omaha at the College World Series, and it is amazing how enthusiastic the people here are about this event and about the sport of baseball in general. I mean, they're drawing better than 22,000 fans. It does kind of have that Field of Dreams feel to it a little bit. We are right on the border of Iowa. It shows me that the spirit of the game of baseball is alive and well, even as, you know, its popularity has been eclipsed by football and maybe even basketball in recent years.
Michael Lev covers University of Arizona baseball and football for the Arizona Daily Star. He joined us from Nebraska, which is where the U of A baseball team continues to be playing in the College World Series. Michael, thanks for the time.
My pleasure.
The Chandler City Council this evening is scheduled to vote to enter into an agreement with the Export-Import Bank. It would make Chandler the first city in Arizona to do so, and supporters say it would make it easier for the city's firms to sell their goods internationally. Eric J. Toll covers the economy for the Phoenix Business Journal and has written about this. And Eric, first off, what exactly is the Export-Import Bank?
The Export-Import Bank is a bank that helps businesses of all sizes, particularly small businesses, to do business overseas, any type of export. And Chandler is the first city in Arizona with an economic development department that's going to have a specialist on Ex-Im Bank services. Calling it a branch is just kind of a, you know, quotation marks in the air branch. But none of the other economic development agencies in the state have that service now. Chandler's doing it because it is landlocked, so they're running out of space for development. And the only way they can grow their economy is for their existing businesses to grow more and do more outside the U.S.
Is this something that Chandler sought out? Is this something that the Ex-Im Bank was looking for a place to go and said, hey, Chandler might be good?
This is something that Chandler sought out. The Ex-Im Bank, I believe, extended invitations to cities, and Chandler, with Michael Miranda as the director there, jumped on it. And their council is very aggressive on economic development.
Why Chandler? Why does this seem like a good fit?
I think Chandler wanted to get on this because they have so many businesses that deal internationally and a lot of businesses that have the potential to deal internationally. Intel is one of the state's largest exporters, as an example. But Chandler is very strong in technology companies, in technology services, and also in auto parts and aerospace. So those are the big exports from Arizona. So Chandler saw the opportunity, and they met with a lot of their businesses that use the Ex-Im Bank to decide that let's move this forward and make it available and make it easy for our businesses to find out about the Export-Import Bank.
So what exactly does this bank do for businesses? I mean, how will Chandler businesses use this bank, and how will they potentially benefit from having it in town?
It's really great. When you clear away all the clouds and dust that were thrown up when the bank is expired last year, the Export-Import Bank has a number of services, but the two biggest services they provide small businesses, one is they guarantee the loans through regular commercial banks for businesses that need the capital in order to get ready to export. Because exporting is easy, but you do need the capital. The second thing they do, which is probably the biggest deal for a small business, is they guarantee the accounts receivable. And when you're dealing with an international company, business sells something, they send out a bill, they expect to get paid 15 to 30 days from sending it out. Internationally, the goods don't transfer until they're received in the foreign country. That could be a 4 to 6 week delay from when they leave the dock here. And then there's another 60 days before payment comes in. The Ex-Im Bank makes sure the local company gets paid on a reasonable cycle, even though the actual payment may take as much as 4 to 5 months.
Eric J. Toll covers the economy for the Phoenix Business Journal. Eric, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark.
Over the past few months, China's Communist Party-controlled media has been widely reporting the existence of an extraordinary document, an ancient Ming Dynasty book that it says proves the country's claim to sovereignty over almost all of the South China Sea. The book was reported to have been a, quote, cherished possession, lovingly kept and wrapped in layers of paper. Such a document could help China prove that history is on its side at an international tribunal in The Hague, which is expected to issue a ruling on the contested waters. But as the BBC's John Sudworth has been finding out, everything is not what it seems.
The fish being landed here in the port of Tianmen on China's southern coast are from some of the most contested waters on the planet. But the Chinese boat captains are unanimous in their view. Of course the South China Sea belongs to China, this captain tells me. We've been going there for generations.
But haven't generations of other fishermen from other countries also been fishing those waters?
He smiles and waves me away, telling me he needs to get on with his work. The official government narrative follows a similar line. China has the right to control up to 90% of the South China Sea, it argues, because its fishermen were there first. And recently, state-run media has been reporting an extraordinary find. A 600-year-old book belonging to a retired fisherman, which is said to record precise navigational directions to far-distant rocks and features. It is described as nothing less than ironclad proof of China's sovereignty. And with an international court ruling on the legitimacy of China's territorial claims expected in the next few weeks, the existence of the document is being given prominent coverage in state-run media. So we went to meet the owner, 81-year-old Su Chengfan, who now spends his time in Tianmen making model boats.
It was passed down from my grandfather's generation to my father's generation, then to me. It mainly taught us how to go to the Paracel and Spratly Islands and how to get back home.
But then, when we asked to see the book, there's a surprising development.
Although this book was important, I threw it away because it was broken.
So you've lost the book?
It is not that I lost it. It was flipped through too many times. The salty seawater from our hands had corroded the book. In the end, it was no longer readable, so I threw it away.
China is not the only country to claim that its fishermen have long been using these waters. But a 600-year-old book would be a powerful document. Without it, though, it offers ironclad proof of nothing at all, except perhaps the willingness of China's Communist Party-run media not to let a few facts get in the way of the official historical narrative.
The BBC's John Sudworth.
It's almost time for the next episode of The Quiz Show. That's when we bring back our resident quiz master and Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions winner Leszek Pavlovich. He'll face off against a KJZZ staff member in a game of trivia, but you can get in on the action too. Just solve this riddle. Throw away the outside and cool the inside, then eat the outside and throw away the inside. What is it? When you have the answer, email us at theshow@kjzz.org. We'll randomly draw two names from the correct answers, and either Leszek or one of our KJZZ newsroom staffers will play on your behalf. If your player wins, you'll win a special KJZZ item.
Our monsoon season officially got started last week, and our daily dose of dust is bound to be unleashed on the valley very soon. That dust, especially with the most violent storms, causes dangerous conditions on the freeways, especially on I-10 between Tucson and Phoenix. So when you have unpredictable weather, how do you keep the dust from getting out of hand and reducing visibility to nil? That's a big part of what Eric Betterton is studying at the U of A. Professor Betterton is the head of the university's Department of Atmospheric Sciences. Professor, what about berms? What effect could they have?
The idea of a berm is to slow down the wind so you don't have high wind speeds and thereby reduce the amount of dust in the air. So it's just separating either the soil or the wind from that combination of wind plus soil.
Several decades ago, there were berms used near parts of Arizona freeways. Bulldozers were brought in to do this. Any idea whether that was effective, ineffective, or was it an idea that just got sort of lost in time? Because it seems as though, as many accidents as we've heard about on I-10, especially in the summer, it would seem like a practical method to at least try again.
The thing about berms or windbreaks in general, you know, people have been using trees as windbreaks for centuries, going way back to the Dust Bowl in the 1930s, for example. The thing about windbreaks or berms is that you need a certain height and in order to reduce the effect of the wind downwind from the berm. And there's a rough rule of thumb so that the effectiveness of a berm is 10 times its height downwind. So a 5-foot berm would be effective in reducing the wind about 50 feet downwind. So in order to get across a huge freeway like the I-10 now, in parts it's three lanes in each direction, you'd need a pretty big berm, you know, maybe 8 or 10 foot high or something like that. Other ways of doing it would be to have a lower berm, but then you'd have to top it with some kind of a tree or shrub or something like that to increase its effective height. Then you've got to worry about irrigation and how to keep those plants alive. So it's non-trivial.
Was there more vegetation? Were there more trees? Was there something that helped hold some of these things in check, especially, as you mentioned, around Picacha?
Well, I've been here for, 25 years or something like that. And I remember near Picacho, there were orchards, and it was pretty green and lush around there. I don't know if you remember that. Those orchards have disappeared. All those trees have disappeared. You see the result. I mean, there's essentially abandoned fields there, which are just really great dust sources. So one way of mitigating dust or controlling the source is to vegetate it, which is very hard to do in the desert southwest, or to try to amend the surface of the soil with some kind of a chemical additive added to some water. You can spray it and form a thin crust on the soil. But then you have to keep people off, because any kind of vehicle traffic or foot traffic or cattle in particular will destroy that crust, and you'll be back to square one.
I want to get into a little bit of the other work you've done as it relates to mining operations. How similar or dissimilar is that from studying the effects of dust on highways? Can you learn from one to apply to the other?
Oh, I think so, yeah. We were studying a Superfund site near Dewey Humboldt. It's called Iron King. That's an abandoned mine tailings which has high concentrations of lead and arsenic in it. So it's important to know how far that dust blows, under what conditions is it generated. We've also been to the Picacho Peak area. We have this portable wind tunnel, and we can spin up a little dust storm.
Well, I have to ask you more details about the portable wind tunnel, because that sounds cool, frankly, to get out there and do that. Can you describe for us what it looks like and how it works?
It doesn't look anything like a tunnel, first of all.
Okay.
It looks like a big cylinder. In fact, we manufactured it out of a big aluminum cooking pot. It's about, I don't know, 18 inches tall or something like that. Down in the middle of it, there's a smooth propeller blade connected to an electric motor, and we slowly dial up the speed of that blade, and eventually it gets sufficiently fast, it creates sufficiently strong wind just an inch off the surface that it creates dust, and we have a dust monitor attached to that inverted pot, and we see the dust generated, and we know how much dust is generated for a particular wind speed.
Professor Eric Betterton is the head of the U of A's Department of Atmospheric Sciences.
The number of hiking-related rescues in Phoenix has been climbing over the last few years. There have already been 136 rescues this year. The data don't show exactly how many of those hikers are from out of town, but it's enough to concern rangers with the city's Parks and Recreation Department.
So they rolled out a new program this week to try to catch visitors to the valley before they hit the trail and educate them about hiking safety. The show's Annika Klein tells us the people they picked for the job are hotel concierges.
That's because a concierge is the first person a tourist might go to when they want to know, what is there to do around town? With just a ring of a bell, the concierge will tell you all the best spots.
We're here to know about the things to do, the attractions and sights to see.
Michelle Caldwell is chef concierge at the Phoenician, a resort right on the tail end of Camelback Mountain. The Cholla Trailhead is within walking distance, and Caldwell says that makes it seem like it's no big deal to walk over and go for a hike.
I've had guests come up in flip-flops thinking, well, I'm just going to go walk a little bit. Or I've had guests come up with very small children.
We classify that as a double black diamond.
That's Ranger Mark Sirota. Some websites classify Camelback's Echo Canyon and Cholla Trails as moderate hikes. But Sirota disagrees.
Those are our two toughest hikes in the Phoenix area.
They're also two of the most popular. The Concierge Education Program aims to train concierge staff in 27 hotels, and they've already started working with the Phoenician.
The 27 that we have targeted are all within 10 miles of mainly the Camelback Mountain and the mountains that we have a lot of injuries and, unfortunately, deaths.
They'll equip these concierge desks with safety tips and trail descriptions so staff can recommend the right trail for a guest. Here at the Echo Canyon Trailhead, the hike might seem easy since it's only a mile and a quarter, but there's also the 1,270-foot incline. I meet a couple people who just finished jogging the last stretch.
Did you do the whole thing?
Yep, we went all the way to the top.
Oh my gosh.
The temperature is 101 at 10:30 in the morning.
I am exhausted, but I feel really great. Little heated.
Rory Nowlin is visiting family with her brother, David. They're from Kansas, and it's their first time in the valley.
It's not extremely difficult. It's treacherous a little bit.
Definitely doable, at least for the Nowlins. But a little ways away, Ranger Jim Sweezy stands and observes returning hikers.
Each day, I've had to catch people and say, hey, how are you feeling? You're very shaky. I see that you're not really sweating in spite of the heat.
And he says quite a few of those hikers were from out of town.
It's a big mistake to come here, get off the plane, and decide to hike. You need to be here in this heat a week or 2 weeks to really get acclimated. And unfortunately, most folks don't have that much time when they're on vacation.
Sweezy says despite rangers' attempts to recommend that people don't hike when it's too hot,
folks don't always want to listen.
Back at the Phoenician, Caldwell says they actually keep tabs on guests now who say they're going hiking.
We start with a cell phone number. I know where my hikers are going. I know the time that they've left. And we do follow up on them to make sure that they are back to the resort safely.
That's not a typical concierge duty, but the park rangers hope that more hotels will do the same after the training program. And maybe next year, the number of hiking rescues will stay lower than the temperatures we've been seeing. For the show, I'm Anika Klein.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.